Philip, M O R G to the A to the N. How are you?
Liston W. Good. How are you, man?
I'm good. I'm actually thinking of legally changing my name to Liston.io. What do you think? Yay or nay?
I think you're going to have a heavy dose of regret about that. Not now, but pretty far down the road.
You know, I'm really surprised to hear you say that, Philip.
Really? Okay. It seemed like a good idea at the time. I guess you could always change it back, though. That's the thing. It's not like getting a tattoo on your forehead.
It is not like that. I am fascinated by people who get face tattoos because I'm always wondering, like, what were you thinking? And generally, when I ask people that who have face tattoos, maybe not surprising that most of them say, I don't know, I thought it would be cool. So,
So you've really done that? You've really questioned people with face tattoos? Like, what were you thinking?
I mean, I didn't interrogate them, and I certainly didn't ask them like the way you just said it, but I just said, you know, I've always wondered, like, what is the thought process? Because not only every time do you look in the mirror, you'll see it, but everybody you ever meet will see your tattoo on your face. Like, what were you know, how did you come to that conclusion? That's the way I would ask.
Yeah, and one of the things you've said about yourself in the past is that you're fascinated with how people make decisions, and this, to me, demonstrates that you really are committed to that quest.
Well, you're not curious about that?
I just, to be honest, I am 100% curious about it and have probably been presented with the opportunity to ask somebody and have probably chickened out. Okay. And have definitely chickened out on taking up that opportunity.
Well, you wouldn't want to ask a stranger, I don't think. I mean, I'm not that forward, but the guy who cuts my hair is an awesome guy, and he has a few face tattoos and one really big one that stretches his whole jawline. And so, you know, I've asked him about some of his tattoos because he's like 27. He's got the face tattoos. He's got a big neck tattoo. His ears are stretched. And I'm like, hey, man, like, what happens when you're my age? And he's like, oh, I don't know. It'll be fine. Like, tattoos are more accepted. He's like, I just want to be a barber. So, you know, I'm not worried about it affecting my job.
The culture will have totally caught up to him by that point. You know, I use that analogy for people. I'm like, you know, moving into a market position and specializing is not like getting a face tattoo. You can change your mind if you need to.
That should be your new headline on your website.
It'd be a pretty good one. I do have a section there where I do little quotes for myself. And right now I've got words to live by on the bottom of the homepage. That's where I stick that stuff.
Well, I think you need that headline and then a picture of yourself with a tattoo photoshopped on your face that says like the positioning guy or something like that.
You have got me confused with somebody else, my friend.
Do I? Okay.
That's that whole personal branding thing. I'll probably have to do that at some point, you know, where you've got the big hero unit at the top and you giving the TED talk or, you know, whatever.
Well, I still don't have that on my site, but I understand why people do it. I mean, it's not just for branding. It's because people want to associate a person.
Yeah.
With it, right? It's I think it's mostly for the visitor, not so much for myself, although I will fully admit that there are probably plenty of people out there who are so egotistical that they're like, you know what would be the best thing to have on my website? Me. But that's not why I would do it. So Philip, tell me, drumroll, are you ready? What are you promoting today?
Oh, crap. I forgot that we do this. Every time.
That's exactly what you said last week.
I know. It's because it's true every time. I'm like, oh, I'm 6 months ago. I'm like, oh, we're going to talk about hip hop music. I'm going to promote Kendrick Lamar's soundtrack for Black Panther. No, I'm kidding.
Are we on
promote
yet?
That? I am going to remind folks that I have a book called Specializing Without Failure. It's at specializingwithoutfailure.com, and it is a pretty good book because it walks you through the process of making that decision. So it's nice and small and easy to read and inexpensive, and I'd like to point people that direction.
Love it. I am going to cheat and promote two things. One is my salesin30.com course, which is available now on my homepage, liston.io, but you can sign up for that. It's a free 10-video course. I did the math today and I have over 18,000 views of this course on LinkedIn, which is surprising.
Wowzers.
Yeah. So that's amazing. So you can get the whole thing for free at salesin30.com. And also, I want to promote a podcast I did with Jake Jorgovan on his website, jake-jorgovan.com, and where we talked about the difference between inbound and outbound leads and how to run an outbound sales process. So that's there for free as well.
You know, Jake is a friend of both of ours, so I feel like I can say this. Why didn't he go with Jake, no dash, jorgovan.com?
I don't have an answer for that.
I just typed it in and it redirects to jake-jorgovan. Maybe you just liked how it looked. Anyway, I was going to be like, wow, why was that domain name not available? That's a such a, you know, awesomely unusual name.
Maybe it's because too many people thought his name was actually Jake Jorg.
Could be. Yeah, I'm sure there's a good reason there. And I should probably not speculate on our podcast about why.
Let's just talk for Jake for the next hour.
Yeah.
While we do that.
Let's talk about how great Jake is.
Since we're not going to do that, thankfully, sorry, Jake, you're off the hook. What we do want to talk about today is profit in a service business. And specifically, Philip, your question was, is profit a lagging indicator of impact or of something else? You want to detail that a little bit? What do you mean?
Let me set this up. So I think we'll probably at some point dive into what is profit. It's, and I, just to give away the punchline, I don't have any kind of amazing, like, insightful definition of profit that's going to totally blow your mind.
Way to sell the show.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's important. What, I mean, this is a thought that I've had kind of bouncing around in my head for a while. And it's stated as an assertion, which is that profit is a lagging indicator of impact. And it kind of comes out of my work with self-employed software developers, where the way I see them chase profitability, which really kind of boils down to, well, just getting a higher rate, because as they chase profitability, they're, you know, they're sort of overhead or their fixed expenses for their business are not likely to change very much, or they're going to stay within a pretty narrow range. So the way they chase profitability is they go for, like, what's the new hot thing, where there's this deficit of supply and an excess of demand for that particular skill set. So if you kind of think back to, like, 2010, and you had some ability to write iOS apps for the iPhone platform, you were in this situation where you were like, holy crap, you know, my rates are twice what they used to be because I learned this iOS thing. Life's pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. And then they see that erode. They see that advantage erode, that you know, revenue or profitability advantage. Becomes harder to get those premium rates because the market becomes more commoditized. There's just more competent supply of that expertise.
Sure.
And that's one kind of pattern you see in the world of software developers, is, you know, they just sort of chase bubbles of excess demand for skills or deficient supply, just depending on which side of it you look at it from. And I think that when you switch your thinking and you start saying, okay, I want to create impact in a business and I want to get paid for the impact that I create for the business, not, I don't want to get paid just because I happen to know this thing that's rare and valuable now, but is going to only be that way for 5 or 7 years. And then it's going to become not rare and not exceptionally valuable. So you switch your thinking, you start saying, you know, what I'm really trying to do is create impact in a business. When you do that, you're sort of embracing a new learning curve. And I think that that delays the kind of profitability you want that to have for you, that new focus on creating business impact. And I think for most people, that is confusing and frustrating, because there's going to be a feeling of like, wait a second, Philip, you told me this was going to make my business better. And I'm sort of in the, you know, the angel on your shoulder or the devil on your shoulder, depending on how you think about it, going, okay, just be patient. The profitability will come, but it's going to take you a couple years to sort of build up the asset, which is this insight that you're developing, this expertise you're developing. And then you can start getting not just nice profitability, but like extreme profitability. But you have to sort of invest in the short term in getting there. So I guess that's what I was thinking when I proposed this as something to discuss with you. What do you think, Mr. W?
So I want to share two concrete examples, and one is nothing to do with me, and the other one is entirely about me. My favorite kind of example. I'm joking.
Nice.
So I was listening to How I Built This. It's a podcast on NPR. Guy Raz is the host, and he had on, forget the guy's name, but Dyson is his name, the guy who founded Dyson Vacuum Cleaners. And so you talk about profits being a lagging indicator of how successful your business is or how successful it is that you're building something. So here's a guy who comes in and he's challenging Hoover. Like, people didn't even call them vacuum cleaners. They called them Hoovers for a long time.
Actually,
right?
In the UK, they still do. That's the verb that they use, at least on UK TV shows. Instead of
right.
vacuuming,
I mean,
it's Hoovering.
Similar to if you were going to call a rideshare program, you'd say, I'll just Uber there, right? And so that's what he was up against. And he thought, well, what if I could sell a bag or a vacuum with no bags? And he realized that the vacuum cleaners or the manufacturer was much more interested in selling bags than making better vacuum cleaners. Mm-hmm. That was their business, like razor blades or, you
printer,
know, shitty
ink,
cheap
ink
printers.
Cartridge. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Right. The $80 HP printer that always clogs, never works very well, but people think, oh my God, what a deal. And then you're like, this is the worst experience of any product I've ever owned.
Yes.
And so that was the model for vacuum cleaners. And so he spent 5 years developing the original Dyson vacuum.
Oh, wow.
5,000 prototypes during that time that he tested against each other in order to arrive at what he thought was finally the first version that he would be willing to sell commercially. Hmm. Also fascinating, unrelated, but fascinating. He took a money loan. He didn't have any venture funding. He took a money loan in order to buy all the tools that he needed to make his first order. And he financed all of the orders with the previous orders. Hmm. And so it's a private company. I was not aware of that, with no outside investment.
Wow.
Until much later, he got some private equity in order to, you know, expand. But,
sure.
You know, there's a perfect example of really, you know, just biting his nails down to the stump for 5 years until he was in a position to sell his vacuum cleaner. And within, I think, the first 2 years, he did almost $200 million in revenue.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Amazing story, right? But none of that would have been possible if he didn't from the beginning say, I have to do something different and I'm not going to compromise on that.
Mm-hmm.
So now let me tell you my experience. So when I started freelancing and consulting, I originally opened up a shop as a marketer and a copywriter. Fast money there.
Mm-hmm.
People want it. They're searching for it actively. They know what it's like to buy that. It's easy to calculate the value. What I didn't do was differentiate and delay because I had a different way of doing things, or I served a particular market. I was just, you know, I mean, I did serve particular markets, kind mm-hmm. of tech and B2B,
mm-hmm.
but, I didn't go far enough on my positioning.
Yeah.
But what it meant was I made money fast.
Right.
And I made good money and probably more money than most freelancers or consultants will make in a year or two. However, that eroded exactly what you're describing.
Yeah.
Over time, as it became more known, you should have a copywriter to help you improve your website, right? Lots of people started going, well, I could do that too. Market becomes crowded in a marketplace where I don't stand out and I'm another option of 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
I can no longer charge what I used to charge. And that's exactly one of the things that happened in my business, that's not ultimately why I left, because I could still charge slightly premium pricing because I'm good at sales.
Yeah.
But that wasn't a defensible position. Now what I'm doing is exactly what you're describing, where I'm building the Liston way and the Liston approach, and I'm serving consultants and agency owners, and I'm very focused on a particular group of people and a particular way of doing things on a particular problem. Because of, I think, some of my previous experience, I've been able to build the business relatively quickly, because I'm partially because I'm good at content.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with you. And, you know, one of the things you were talking about leading up to this was that there are three stages that you see in a business, kind of an early stage, the adolescent years, which obviously is everybody's favorite time in their whole life, is the adolescent years, and maturity. And yeah. If you're lucky, your business makes it to adolescence, so you have a shot at reaching maturity.
Yeah.
But that's exactly where I feel I'm in now, is this early stage, the very beginning, where I'm like, wow, so much to figure out. I don't know what I don't know. And there's no way I can charge what I would call a rent, to borrow a economics term, which is just to say, let's say every consultant or every coach in the world who I'm competing with charges $1,000 for one unit, whatever that is, doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
When I reach profitability, or my rent would be if I could charge $3,000 for the same thing, or $5,000, or even $1,500, but I have a difference in what I can charge against the market because I'm differentiated permanently. And that's what I'm building towards.
Yeah. And so, yeah, with that lead up, I was going to be surprised if you did not fundamentally agree. I think there's edge cases. There's places where, you know, profitability is extreme from day one, or, you know, I'm sure there's like exceptions to this, but it does feel like a common pattern. And it sort of highlights that I think there's two ways you can go. One way is you can be happy with market rate. I think that might figure into our discussion of like my awkward attempts to probably define profitability a bit later in this episode will have something to do with market rate. Because, I mean, technically, I guess profitability is any money you make that you don't need to live on. You know, as let's just scope this to a company that has low expenses, no payroll. I think they would think of profitability as like, oh, well, I needed $7,000 to live on this month and I made 10. So my profit was 3,000. Right.
Well, so let's start with the accounting definition, right? So the accounting definition of profitability would be any money that's left over after all expenses are paid. Now, the tricky part is, well, what are expenses? And so, you know, when I worked at a 80-person consulting firm, expenses were all salaries, all office costs, all technology, all advertising, like everything that went into delivering to clients. Mm-hmm. Anything that was left over was then distributed to partners, which I think was typically in like the 10 to 15% range.
Sure.
Right. As a solo business owner, I agree with you. I would look at it as like, okay, what is my please don't ever come under this number kind of
right.
monthly number that I want to hit?
Yeah.
So for, you know, it could be anything for you. If it could be 2,000, it could be 12,000. I mean, I don't know what it is for people listening to this, but let's just say it's like 6,000. So I agree with you. If I got 10,000, well, your profitability is huge. It's 4,000 over your 6,000 that you needed. That's 67%. And so what we'd like to do is get into the range of being able to charge a multiple of whatever that baseline number is. And that takes time.
Yeah, so I think there's maybe a slightly nuanced, in a sort of nuanced way, a different way to think about profitability, which is there is at least an idea of a market rate, right? There's like a range of, what do you think the market rate is for a reasonably skilled copywriter doing the kind of copy that you were saying became less and less lucrative for you, or less and less profitable?
Yeah, $50 to $70 an hour would be, so yeah, I can go on about market rates for a while. I have a strong opinion about this, but totally, let's call it the mean.
Yeah, right? Let's limit ourselves.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, let's limit ourselves to speaking in terms of an hourly rate, which is something a lot of us want to get away from. Some of us have already, but anyway, yeah, just
but it's
hourly
easy to
rate
talk about.
It's easy to talk
as,
about
as a unit.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I say market rate, what I mean is if you populated all the different rates people charge, mm-hmm. what is kind of the middle of yeah. that?
Right.
And so I would say it's like $50 to $70 okay. an hour, something like that.
Okay. So to me, there's another way to look at profitability, which is how far above that are you earning in your business?
Right.
How far above that kind of mean, quote unquote, market rate are you actually earning? And that's closer to how I actually think of profitability. Like, I don't think it should matter where you live or how much you work or anything like that. I think more of profitability as what kind of premium or what, as you suggested, what economic rents are you capturing on essentially your business, but really your expertise or the value you can provide.
Right.
That's more how I think about it. And to me, especially that kind of profitability is something I feel like you have to invest in to achieve it in a services business. I feel like it's quite difficult to achieve that from day one. So, you know, I live in Northern California where the cost of living is among the highest in the country. You know, this used to live here. It's,
I did. I paid the price.
Yeah. So I could, increase my profitability almost overnight by moving to a cheaper place to live. You know, I could move.
Exactly. I agree.
You know, some backwater in Mississippi or something like that and rent a house for $300 a month or something. You know, like I could do that. I wouldn't want to, and I have no intention to do that. But theoretically, I could increase my profitability that way. But I'm still selling the same thing. And compared to the market rate, nothing's changed. So to me, that's not a great way to measure profitability. Like that delta between your cost of living and what you can earn, to me, is not a great way to measure profitability.
I see your point. Yeah, I think measuring against the market. Now, let's be honest, though. Market rates are influenced by where people are. Right?
That's true. There are local differences. Yep.
They're building in their own costs of where they live.
Yeah,
right?
A copywriter in Manhattan is going to charge more than a copywriter in, you know, Biloxi, Missouri or whatever.
Yeah. So my advice to that person is get a new career if you're going to stay in Manhattan. Because it's going to be a tough slog. But I did want to talk about this idea of profit being a lagging indicator. And I agree. So like, if you're going to benchmark against the market, it's going to take you a while to reliably surpass or multiply market rates in order to achieve profitability. I wrote on this the other day about what are leading indicators or like what are, you know, Mark Butler talks, he has a podcast about signs of life mm-hmm. in your business. And I think this is an important concept because, you know, the question being, well, if I don't know, or if I'm not hitting a market multiple now, and what you're telling me, Philip Morgan, is I have to go out and spend a few years in order to achieve it, how do I know if I'm on the right track to reach my ultimate destination?
Yeah.
And I have some strong opinions about that, but kind of what are some of the things you tell people to look for early on to see if they're on track or not?
Embarrassing confession. I've not quite thought of it this way. And I, as you mentioned Mark's podcast, I was like, oh yeah, maybe we're both sort of subconsciously riffing off of that because we're both fans, I think, of his podcast. And and he did talk about this, these sort of leading indicators that may have prompted this thought for me. So I'm kind of answering this real time and pretty convinced I'm not going to do a great job of it. But I think there are some things like Derek Sivers said the following, and it kind of somewhere between annoyed and upset me. And he said, like,
Tell me more.
He's gone on record saying he thinks no one should start a business unless someone else asks them to. And
That's weird.
I understand what he's getting at. He's like, you shouldn't start a business until you have demand for your for the business, proven demand. And one way that that can show up is someone else is like, gosh, you know, this is so great. Can I pay you to do this? Or do you do this professionally or what have you? And I think that that is sort of mirrors his kind of origin story for CD Baby. It irritated me because I think that excludes a lot of people from running businesses who otherwise would be very happy to run their own business. That's why it kind of irritated me. And also nobody ever asked me to go in business for myself. So I kind of felt like personally, called out or something.
Oh, so what he means is you have a customer base who want it, basically. He's not saying, you know, someone else out there is saying, hey, Derek, would you please start specifically this business for me?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. You're not responding to somebody else's specific request that you start some kind of business they've envisioned, but it's a sort of quippy way of him saying, don't start a business where there's no demand.
Right.
And again, I partially agree with that sentiment. So what I wanted to say is like one of the leading indicators though, that I would tell people to expect is some kind of feedback from the market. You feel, I call it, you know, you just feel an echo. You like perceive or sense some kind of echo where it's like, yes, this is a thing we want. So if you're doing, you know, customer development interviews to do market research, it might end up with somebody saying, so do you do this for a living? Because if so, we'd like to talk to you about it. That's one example of a sort of echo, a ping kind of back from the market, a sign of life, if you will. That's one thing. I feel like you might have better ideas, though. What do you think? What are the leading indicators from your perspective?
Well, so it sort of depends on your strategy for building your business, but I'll give you a couple for me. So, you know, I do a lot of video marketing, a lot of content marketing. Mm-hmm. I have an email list. And so people sign up for my email list and I ask them questions along the way. Mm-hmm. And what I'm looking for is excitement and unsolicited feedback and inbound leads mm-hmm. that I'm not, you know, they're just happening
yeah.
because of what I'm doing. And when I see that stuff and I'll ask people, you know, like, why are we on the phone right now? And they're like, well, I saw your article on this and I watched your video and I just thought, you know, I've been putting this off for a while. And when I saw you, I thought you'd be the person to help me with this. Mm-hmm. That's really strong.
Right? That is. I mean, that now, is huge.
Now, I don't have, you know, my, and maybe this is a limiting belief and you can respond to this. I don't believe I can charge a 3 or a 5x against the market because I don't have the track record quite yet in my new coaching business, right? I think I have a solid track record in that I've built my own business and I've got, you know, I can tell a story of how I went from 20K to 250K in just 2 years in revenue and how I sold a $1 million contract at my previous employer years ago. There's some great credibility I have. But if people are asking me, what's your coaching experience? Like, I can't say, look at all the good stuff I've done. Right. So
that didn't stop that electrical contracting company in Puerto Rico from having their first government contract for however many billions of dollars. But generally, I agree that a couple things, it's very difficult to decouple your pricing from your level of confidence.
Well, yes and no. Well, okay, so a couple things there, but I want to go back to your Puerto Rico example just okay. so that we're not leaving people with the wrong impression. First of all, they had a guy on the inside. Ah. I think they had a personal relationship with Ryan Zinke. Ah. And also, they ended up losing that contract. So they didn't actually win it.
It was a very cheap, flimsy example.
After public outcry, they were forced out of that because of their obvious ineptitude and lack of qualifications. Now, I will say that early on with pricing, to your point, and trying to extract profitability early on, I feel like I really want these success stories. I want stories to tell, right? And so I'm not going to gouge someone. Gouge is the wrong word.
I was surprised you used that word. Go ahead.
That's not what I mean. I'm sorry. It was a poor choice of language. What I mean is I'm not going to go to my higher end of where I think I could be.
Right.
Because I want the project and I want to make sure that it kicks ass. Right.
Yeah.
So that the next time I come around, and I'm a big fan of like people go, well, how do you raise your prices? And I'll just say, well, mark it up 10 or 20% every time and keep going. Right.
Yeah. But what I want to make explicit about what you're saying is you're investing in that future ability to charge a premium rate by charging, we could call it a competitive rate, or I don't even know what market rate is for what you do. So
I don't fully either. I would say probably a competitive rate, probably on the higher end, not probably, definitely on the higher end of average.
Yeah. So you're charging a competitive rate now, but what it seems to me you're doing is doing that very purposefully so that you can build up what you feel like you need to charge a premium rate.
That's right.
I think there's, and this is not advice at all, but I think there's this weird relationship between pricing and perceived value. And so in an alternate universe, if you were charging just nosebleed, stratospherically high prices for what you do now, I think there's a chance some people would look at that and say, well, I can afford it, and I want to know that I'm buying the best. And this guy's prices are so much higher than anybody else's, he must be the best.
Right.
And so you use the price as a signaling mechanism for credibility, for quality, for what the experience must be like. But it's very risky to do that, because if you do that and you really are not experienced, you will probably underdeliver on what people's expectations are for a premium experience. Or you'll just give them the wrong stuff thinking that's what they want, but they really, what they, you know, makes for a great experience for them is something else. So, I don't know if that nuance is helpful or not, but I do think you can use price as a sort of signaling mechanism. And maybe if you were lucky, you could have that massive profitability now. But I think you're pursuing it seems to me, a much smarter approach, which is let's forego a little profitability now in order to build a stronger foundation.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, and in terms of those leading indicators, so excitement is a great one. Yeah. Conversation is a great one. If I'm asking people, and this happens all the time, I was just showing one of my coaching clients who was saying, oh yeah, I have to build this funnel and all the stuff I need to do. And I was like, well, you know, I just email people and say, thanks for signing up. What's going on?
Yeah.
And I had a guy the other day write like 3,000 words over two emails. And I was like, first of all, amazing. Right. And it feels like I'm touching on something when I'm getting that level of response, when I know people could be doing any order of other things besides talking to me.
Yeah.
And so that to me feels like a really strong indicator of, okay, I'm moving in the right direction. This is good.
I agree. Right? I've seen the same thing with email marketing, where I feel like if you're getting unsolicited questions back from your list, not responses to specific questions like, oh, tell me about your biggest problem in business or whatever, but like just unsolicited responses to the things you are sending to the list, that also I would lump under the leading indicator, like you're doing something right. There's a 2% chance you're just a dummy and you're not explaining things well, but there's a 98% chance you're touching a nerve or saying something that's relevant or interesting to people.
We couldn't rule out the former though.
Nope. No. Can't get to 100% certainty there.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I think that's one. I think also something that I've been hearing from a lot of people is, I'd really love your help, but I don't think I can afford you. Okay. That feels like, all right, we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
Not that I want to preclude people from working with me. That's not the goal, but there's a level of perceived value that I've built, and that statement is indicative of it. And I've heard it multiple times from different people.
You know, even more fundamentally than that, it means that you're actually succeeding at describing what you do. It seems so simple. But yeah, the more you get away from, I will charge you $70 an hour to write copy, the further you get away from that being how you describe your services, and the closer you get to something that's unique, something that solves a real business problem, something that is, well-positioned. Paradoxically, I find the harder it becomes to describe what it is you do, because there's a portion of what you do that you invented yourself. You made it up because you saw a need in the market and you responded to that and you came up with something that just isn't available a lot of other places. And all of a sudden, there's this new burden on you to actually explain it to people. It's so funny to me, but I've seen it in my own business. I've seen it in other people's businesses too.
Yeah. I think we talked about categories before and how Seth Godin, I'm on his blog right now. He says, if we put someone in the category of frequent business traveler, we can apply previous learnings about what people like this might want or need. Categories are useful tools when they help us find shared worldviews or interests. And I agree with that. I think there's this dual challenge of really effectively positioning yourself. So like for you, and you can tell me if this is true or not, you're basically a positioning consultant, right? Is that how people would perceive you, do you think?
Yep. And I know that because, people are like writing to in response to emails from my list and saying stuff like, you're the positioning guru. I don't love the word guru, but whatever. Or you're the man when it comes to positioning. So yes, very much yes to what you said.
Yeah. So you're the positioning guy. So on the one hand, you have this challenge of like telling people what that means and what are the ramifications for how you can serve them. And it builds value for you. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the downside is who else is in the positioning guru group? Yeah. David C. Baker, maybe Al Reese, but like very few people in the world. This is not a known profession.
Yeah, I think Blair Enns too. But yeah, there's not a lot of precedent. There's almost no precedent for, okay, what does a guy like you do? And so I'm building a thing called specialization school. Same challenge there. It's like, I know what a 2-year trade school does. I do not know what a specialization school does. I'm pretending to be a prospective client. And that's part of the cost to me that eats away at my profitability is I have to help people understand what I do. They understand the problem. Using breakthrough advertising author. Eugene Schwartz's language. I have a market that's problem aware, but they're not really solution aware. And that means I have to do a lot of education, which I'm fine with, but for me, it makes an even more extreme case of delayed profitability.
Uh-huh.
I think you have less of a problem with that because your level of market awareness, I would characterize as pretty much solution aware. They know that there are these people called sales trainers or sales coaches or sales experts, and they kind of know what they do. So I feel like you're a little bit you just have a little bit of an easier situation in terms of market awareness.
Right. And then, so my bigger challenge is, well, how do I stand out of that crowd, right? What's different about me?
Right.
And which is why I've talked a lot about my own personal values and like, what should a sale be? This isn't me getting over on someone else, right? That's a huge part of my message.
Yeah. That's a good point. There's no free lunch. It's like the work that I'm having to do in education, you're having to do almost as much in differentiation.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't have to teach, although I will say a lot of people have never paid for a coach, right? So there's some education that goes in there too. Like, okay, well, what do I get? How does this work? We've talked about selling advice on this podcast before.
Yeah.
And as murky as it can be to sell advice, I think it's even worse to buy advice for the first time. Like, what is this? Like, I'm not, how does this work? How do I hold it? What do I get? How much do I get? What if you don't deliver enough? Like, all these questions kind of come up naturally.
Oh, you're right. The culture has so much embedded what to expect type of education about so many things, but like buying advice other than maybe hiring a therapist is something I think a lot of people are at sea about how to even do it for the first time.
That's a good question or a good point. I've never thought about paying a therapist as buying advice.
Yeah, I mean, some therapists would say, no, the answers come from you, not from me. So some therapists would take issue with that. But I mean, if you think about it, like, where do everyday people buy advice? Maybe hiring an attorney, maybe hiring a CPA, and, you know, maybe hiring a therapist. They would get advice from their doctor, but I think most people ignore that advice.
Well, and also that's seen as medical treatment.
I think
more like, I don't think people would put that in the buying advice category.
Yeah. It's advice decoupled from, from other stuff. So
maybe a nutritionist. Yeah.
Pretty rare, I would say. I mean, what percentage of people have ever hired a nutritionist? I don't know, but that's a good example.
I would think.
Yeah. That's a good example.
I mean, how many people care enough about what they eat to even think about hiring a nutritionist? I don't know what that number is either.
But yeah, I mean, the larger point is, I think we're right that most people are, when they buy advice, it's likely the first time they've done that.
So I talked about, I think, excitement. This is one of those big early indicators that I would look for to know whether or not I'm on the right track. And you know, I wrote about this recently. If you go to my daily blog on my website, you can look up consulting lead generation, finding progress early. And, you know, basically anything you want to achieve in your business, there's going to be something that has to happen before that happens in order for your ultimate outcome to even be possible. So in this case, if we're talking about profitability, right, obviously I need some level of sales or market awareness in order to have a chance of increasing my rates at some point. So we don't want to focus on vanity metrics, but at the same time, like, if my goal is to land 10 clients a month, or for most consulting businesses, it would be more like 3 additional clients in the next 12 months.
Yeah.
Like, that can't be a weekly measurement metric, but what you could look at is how many new people did you contact?
Right.
And of those, how many people had a problem that you can help them solve? And of those, how many did you get a follow-up meeting with? And those are the kinds of things that early on would really help you, I think, look for some of these leading indicators that you're on the right track. Now, if you're often hearing things like, and this is going to sound like music to your ears, Philip, if you're talking to someone in a consulting sale and you're hearing things like, yeah, but service provider Y does the same thing as you and they only charge $80 an hour, or they only charge $50 an hour. If you're hearing things like that, I would contend you're probably not positioned well enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to be in a position where you can't be easily compared to that person.
Yeah, generally that's true. Again, exceptions to everything. I got distracted listening because you made me remember the favorite label that has ever been applied to me by somebody else, which is the positioning OG.
Ah, the positioning OG. But is that really true? Are you really the original?
No, but for this person, I was, because I don't think they'd read Al Reese or any of my predecessors. But yeah, for this guy, Dan, who's a really great guy, for him, I was the positioning OG. Anyway.
I think we just decided on your face tattoo.
Okay. it might take me a little while to muster up the courage for that, buddy.
I hope so.
Are we getting together next time I'm in Portland?
yes. Yes.
Oh, shit. This podcast is leading very interesting places.
Horrible, horrible places. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, if you want to charge rents, right? Which, you know, in your business, you should want to do that, because essentially it allows you to do higher quality work in less time for more money,
right.
For people who get more value out of it. If you can do that, I mean, really, to me, what I'd be looking for early on is excitement, lead flow, attention, right? How much attention are you getting on the things that you're doing? Mm-hmm. Those would all be really important indicators that you're on the right track.
Yeah. I mean, in the kind of work I do, one thing that would be a leading indicator is someone writing out of the blue and saying, "You changed my life," which has happened multiple times to me. And of course, it's humbling and, you know, gratifying, but it's also like a leading indicator because, you know, again, for me, like profitability is, to an extent, it's happening now, but the kind of profitability I really want is a little further down the road, I think, for me. So it's nice to see that, and I would call that a leading indicator as well. It's the excitement you're talking about. It really fits under that umbrella, but it's also, you know, it's like so vivid when that happens. I'm like, wow, that, I mean, how often does that happen to the average freelancer?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I'm not trying to be dismissive of that kind of work, but I just feel like there's potential for much more if you're willing to work at it and take some risks. And I guess I would add to that, to delay profitability for a couple of years while you work on really figuring out how to be impactful in the work you do in your business. It's not like you just go away on a, you know, on a vision quest and come back with this perfectly formed idea about how to create impact for your clients. I think it takes time and experimentation to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And one thing I want to point out is this idea of excitement or, you know, compliments or fan mails is kind of the thread.
Mm-hmm.
It will only apply if you do a lot of public marketing, right? That's the only way to get this kind of attention back onto your business. So the reason I bring this up is I think of Blair Enns, what mm-hmm. he said when I interviewed him and on some other podcast. I asked him, well, you know, you don't do value pricing. Like, why are you going around talking about value pricing when you uh-huh. have a canned?
Yeah.
He said, well, I do a productized service. And he said, you know, if I had it my way and I lived in a big city, I would just value price 2 clients a year and charge them hundreds of thousands of dollars for an engagement.
Uh-huh.
And I'd make a lot of money doing a lot less work.
Yeah.
Now, if that's your model, you don't need a lot of excitement around what you're doing. However, I would argue Blair would be hard pressed to do that without the success of the Win Without Pitching manifesto
yeah.
or some of his other work. So there are definitely service businesses that succeed in spite of being relatively quiet
mm-hmm.
or in spite of not having a strongly differentiated and public message. But I'd say that is the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so too. I mean, luck is this amazing thing. You know, luck smiles on you and you're like, wow, I didn't have to listen to any of this advice. I just did it my own way. And look at me, I'm rolling in the Teslas.
Right.
But, you know, luck is not equally available to everyone at all times. And I think there are things that compensate really well for, you know, luck not smiling on you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. I don't think I can think of any other leading indicators. I guess the thing I would challenge anyone listening to this to start to think about is what is the precursor to whatever that final outcome is that you want? So if it's building in profitability, like what are some of the things that would need to happen? And for a lot of businesses, I would argue you really do need lead flow in order to be able to really raise your price so that you have the confidence to walk away from deals where people want to negotiate with you. And I think that that's an important indicator as well.
Yeah, a surplus of opportunity makes so many other things easier. Yep. You can probably tell my voice is waning. Interviewed David or had a conversation with David Baker for my podcast this morning.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I'm sorry I couldn't be as expert as he is. He wrote the book on it after all.
You're good enough. Good enough for my purposes. Listen.
I'm the throwaway podcast of the week.
You're good enough for government work.
Philip, I do want to ask everybody, if you're enjoying this podcast, and I think I didn't mention this to you, but I got an email subscriber from someone who listens to our podcast this last week. So that was exciting.
Oh, I hope I get the next one. You got this one. I hope I get the next one.
Yes. Ball's in your court to make that happen.
Yep, yep.
But if you're listening to this and you get something out of it, we would absolutely love it if you could leave a review and or just tell someone else about the podcast, because we love expanding our little family of offline listeners. So thank you so much for listening, and please do leave a review. It helps us spread the word.
Word.
Anything else you want to say about Kendrick Lamar before we go?
Yeah, I got to listen to that again. I listened to it once. And I was like, there were two or three tracks. I was like, wow, the production on this track is great, but you know, nothing else about it grabbed me. So I need to give it more than just a hot take.
The one of the songs, the refrain of the song is, "Are we on 10 yet? Are you on 10 yet? Are you on 10 yet?" And so I keep saying that over and over again, and my wife wants to kill me. She has banned me from singing this song ever in the house. So, but I like that one. That's my favorite song on that album.
I'll have to check that out. All right, buddy. Good talking to you.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye.